We begin with a couple of items from the question box. Number one, what is the date of Polycarp's letter to the Ephesians? Actually, I may not have made this clear. Polycarp, we only have one surviving letter from Polycarp, and he wrote it to the Philippians. So we don't have a letter of Polycarp to the Ephesians. His letter to the Philippians would range, and I'll put this up here. Would range from 110 to 140 AD. We do have a letter written by Ignatius to the Ephesians. And again, we don't know precisely when that was written, but it's thought that Ignatius was martyred during the reign of Trajan, and Trajan died in 117. So it would be somewhere in that early part of the second century. Somewhere in there. That ought to catch it. And we did talk about Ignatius a little bit yesterday, just using him as an example of the change in church government that was made during his time, apparently. At least he speaks very highly of it and seems to be a big promoter of it. I'm using this as sort of symbolic of the great apostasy. When Eusebius was writing his history of the church at the beginning of the 4th century, the name of Ignatius was renowned almost everywhere. Everybody seems to have known about him. And I think it's highly likely that it was Ignatius himself who pushed and maybe even created this strong central church government in Antioch of Syria, where he was from. As you know from the book of Acts, the church at Antioch of Syria was one of the oldest churches outside of Jerusalem. The gospel was first preached there by refugees from the persecution that had cost Stephen its life down in Jerusalem. And they went to the Jew first and also to the Greek in the 11th chapter of the book of Acts and the 19th through 21st verses. It was in Antioch that the disciples were first called Christians. There were prophets there. There were teachers there. It was a home base for Paul, from which he was sent out as an evangelist. So there's a lot of background on this church, and it seems like that Ignatius was really pushing this, and I think the reason he emphasizes it in the letters, and I read to you a little bit from these letters yesterday. I can do that again, because the next question I am asked is there any indication of the bishop in Ephesus in Ignatius' days? And absolutely, yes, there is. From the Apostolic Fathers, we read in the Ephesian letter written by Ignatius about Onesimus, who is your bishop. And the mention of your bishop is emphasized here on almost every page. Your honorable presbytery, which is worthy of God, is attuned to the bishop, even as it strings to a lyre. He talks about, be careful not to resist your bishop. We ought to regard the bishop as the Lord himself. And on. He says, don't do anything apart from the bishop. Obey the bishop. It just shot through with that. So it's definitely true that, I mean, there's no question, but what Ignatius was pushing, the idea of a one-man leadership hierarchical system in all of these churches. And this developed into the papal system. At first you had a pope in each one of these towns, and then eventually you had the Pope of Rome as the universal. But eventually the word pope was used for all of these people. And I think Ignatius really was having a difficult time selling this, and this is why he's writing these letters. He's insisting on a single bishop as the sole focus of unity and authority in a whole area. And from the way he wrote about it, it indicates perhaps that this was a very hard idea to sell at first. And it should have been hard to sell. It should have never been bought by the church. But eventually it was won out. So we can go from Paul's letter to the Ephesians that we have in the New Testament, written 60-something A.D. probably, where you have a plurality of elders. Paul had called for the Ephesian elders when he was on one of his preaching trips, remember? And the elders from Ephesus came to him. They were equal in authority, equal in responsibility, a plurality of elders at Ephesus in the 60s. And then 60 years later, if that, there's been a big change that took place. And it's easy for us to wonder how this can happen in a congregation or in an area. But it certainly can. It depends on sometimes those little incremental decisions that we make, what precedents we allow to be set in the church. We talked here on Sunday afternoon about 100 years of history. If you read Chuck Waterworth's book, you saw that even back 100 years ago, there were elders. There was a plurality of elders serving the congregation here. This congregation, as far as I know, has always had a plurality of elders over it. So you wonder, what was the problem at a place like Ephesus? Well, I can tell you this, that the Nixa congregation has not come through 100 years of history without trauma and trial. Back in the midsection of the history of this congregation, there was a struggle, a deathmatch struggle for the heart and soul of this congregation. And because brethren stood fast for the faith, you still have a congregation that's recognizable as one of the Lord's. But it wouldn't have had to have been that way if other decisions had been made and had prevailed. So we must not take for granted that things are just going to continue on in the Lord's way. You who are in positions of decision-making and you who will be have to think in terms of what precedents are we setting, what might this lead to, and try to keep comparing everything we do with the Word of God. It doesn't happen by accident. Ignatius seems to think that it is of extreme and immense significance that he, as the Bishop of Syria, is going to be martyred at Rome. And he even goes so far as to assure the Romans, when he writes to them, that you will never again have a chance to be associated with such an important event as my martyrdom. He actually comes out and indicates this. When I first read that many, many years ago, it was back in the days that Dick Cavett had a talk show on TV, and I saw that Dick Cavett show one night, and he was interviewing Norman Mailer, and Norman Mailer was, I don't know if you know anything about him or not, but he thinks a lot of himself. At one point during this interview, Dick Cavett said, should I have an extra chair brought out for your ego? And when I read Ignatius' statement about you're never going to see such an important thing in your life as my martyrdom, it reminded me of that statement from Dick Cavett. There is pride involved in the upper echelons of these offices, and that's probably one reason that the Lord's Church is very flat in its organization. You don't have anybody who is supposed to be able to collect a lot of power. There are checks and balances built into the Lord's system. We'll, Lord willing, talk about this next week when we are looking at the Christian system. But man wants to tend, at least some men, want to tend to accumulate power unto themselves. So we see that happening here, and I think we can probably let that stand for the development of the great apostasy. You have a timeline there in your notebooks, and many of the events listed there are the specifics of how the great apostasy came to its development. What I want us to be sure we understand about that is the spirit behind the apostasy. And I'm not sure that it's really so very different from the spirit of Cain. Cain, really, we don't have any reason to believe that Cain had been living a wicked life up till the time that he made his decision he did about the offering. We don't have a lot of facts about it, but we do know that by faith Abel offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, Hebrews 11:4. We know from Romans 10:17 that faith comes by hearing the Word of God. Therefore, if Abel offered by faith, God must have told them something about what to do. And Abel did it, it would seem, and Cain did not do it. Cain offered a cereal offering, which was later ordained, but never for a sin sacrifice. Never given, as far as we know, to anybody who wasn't living under the Mosaic law. We can well understand what Cain must have thought or might have thought, if we give him the benefit of the doubt. Cain might have thought, well, if Abel's going to offer what he works with every day, I'll just offer what I work with every day. Abel raises these sheep, so he'll offer that. I raise these grains, so I'll offer that. You can understand the thinking behind a lot of these changes. You can understand the thinking that says, well, it would be more efficient, and wouldn't it be more effective if we had a man over everything who could be a good executor, keep things moving and going? We're awfully unorganized as we are now. You can understand this kind of human thinking. We all can. But we need to understand that God gave a plan because it was the way that He wanted it to be. He's at least as interested in the processes of how things work as He is in the end product. And the problem is, if we change the process, we really come out with a different product than what God intended at the end. It may seem more efficient, but it doesn't wind up in the place where it really needed to go. That's the spirit, and we see it's as old as the human race. We see it in the case of Abraham and Sarah, where God has made this prediction, this promise, that Abraham is going to have a son and his seed will be called through that son. And Sarah is worrying about this. Abraham's not getting any younger and neither am I. God has made this promise, but he stepped out too far on the limb when he made the promise, and God cannot fulfill this promise through me. I know he can't. And so she does something that violates the nature of womanhood. She gives her husband another woman. What woman wants to do that? I think Sarah did this at great sacrifice to herself. But she wants God's promise to be fulfilled, and she can't see any other way. So she goes beyond the boundaries of what God has given for human relationships, says to Abraham, take Hagar, slave girl that we got down in Egypt, since you lied down there and didn't tell the whole truth about our relationship. We got this slave girl out of that deal, so just take her and have a son by her, and that'll be the child of promise. Abraham didn't have any word of God on that. All he had was the word of Sarah, but he went ahead and did it. You know the problems that this caused. We see this in almost every generation in the Old Testament history. It's the spirit of apostasy. In the next generation, Rebekah goes beyond what she should have to try to be sure that her favorite son, Jacob, was well taken care of, as opposed to the older son, Isaac, the older son Esau that Isaac liked the best. I'm sure that Rebekah meant well in what she did and having Jacob lie and all that. But she didn't do one bit of good for the Lord. You can trace this in every situation. Look at Saul. Look at the contrast between the judges, a rather inefficient system of government, and the kingship, which was what the people wanted. And they had a uniting figurehead to lead them forth to battle once they had a king. Once they had a king, they always had a king or a queen, a monarch, until their kingdom fell. So it's the difference between the way God looks at things and the way man looks at things. And it's a very important lesson for us. If we can get that lesson impressed on our minds, then we don't have to know all the specifics about holy water and Lent and Easter and the doctrine of penance and the elders assuming the title of priest. These things that you see down the list. I've had several of you tell me that you don't think it's really a very mandatory idea to spend a lot of time on the medieval history. And I sort of agree with you on that. The preponderance, there are two main things among the people that I've talked to, and I've talked to a number of you as I could, about what we should emphasize on this class. There were two main focuses for that. Number one, what about the church in the wilderness? Where was it? Can we trace it? And the other one was about the restoration movement. A lot of people here are interested, especially in the American church, and want to spend a lot of time on the restoration movement. So I'm going to try to accommodate that. We're talking now a little bit about the apostasy. We come to the time where the apostasy develops to the point where we have a universal bishop. I'll just read to you one little sentence out of the Oxford Dictionary of Popes that I introduced to you yesterday. From 533 A.D., the pope mentioned here is John II, who followed Boniface II, and it was during this period of time that the change was made. It's so incremental and gradual that some people would say Boniface II is the one that we ought to look at here. But this particular dictionary refers to Justinian, who was the Eastern Emperor. Remember, the Western Roman Empire fell in 476, and it left a vacuum there. He who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. But when he was taken out of the way in 476, this opened up a power vacuum that the Bishop of Rome stepped into. He'd been accumulating power over generations for a long time. Now the Eastern Emperor, Justinian I, we were told here about John. This is on page 58 of the Dictionary of Popes. John II, to whom Justinian had written in deferential terms, acclaiming Rome as the head of all the churches. So that's one place you can nail down in this, in a source, a historical source, of just when the Bishop of Rome began to be recognized as the universal bishop, because he was the head of the churches. He began to be regarded as the head over the Pope, the Papa over all the churches. And from there was an acceleration of apostasy. And we know this story all too well. We've got several pages of dates here as we see this continue on and on. And it just got worse and worse. The nadir of the papacy, perhaps, is in the time of the pornocracy that we see down here later. These were very vulgar people in many cases. After the time of Constantine, the Christian faith was the state religion of the Roman Empire, and that's what really changed everything. Because now it became popular to be a so-called Christian. You did it for political reasons. If you wanted to be in the government, you needed to be a Christian. And it was no longer for spiritual reasons. They began to think in terms of everybody in the nation being a part of the church. And it was a very difficult thing for the true people of God during this time. But there always were true people of God. Jesus Christ has never, since the inception of the church, been a king without a kingdom, or a shepherd without a sheep, or a head without a body. He always has had people trying to follow him. The more power that was accumulated by the state church, the more persecution there was against the true people of God. And we read about people in history known by a number of different names that their enemies in general gave them, who probably were the true people of God, when we try to look at where the church actually was. We should think in those terms. Since you've had some number of questions about where was the church during the Dark Ages, somebody said. What about the church in the wilderness, as it's spoken of in Revelation chapter 12? One time I read this little book called Tradition and History of the Churches of Christ in Central, of the Early Churches of Christ in Central Europe by Hans Grimm. That I think is really worth looking at. You can get this online, and I don't think most of you would have much trouble finding it. I'll just read you a little bit about what he says about himself. He writes this booklet and talks about the churches of Christ as he had known them and as he had researched them in Central Europe before his own time. He says, "I was born in 1899. I'm just going to skip through here and read a few sentences. I obtained a license in comparative history of religions. I was imprisoned in 1933 by the Nazis for preaching the gospel in the face of a blasphemous government. I had to suffer almost 2 years in concentration camps. Released, deaf in one ear and with crushed kidneys, I had to sell my special library and furniture to manage to live. 3 months after my wedding, I was arrested in 1948 by the communists and for 4 years imprisoned by them. Released in the fall of 1952, I was invited to take over the office of president of the Evangelical Academy. I declined because I could not subscribe to the promise not to attack the teaching of the Confession of Augsburg. The Augsburg Confession is very important in this area of the world around Germany and all that. It goes along with Lutheranism. And so he said that I, in the same month, this is 1952, I met for the first time in my life a member of the Restored Churches of Christ of America. My grandfather had had contacts with Scottish, Haldane Baptist, and Sandemanians, yea, even with the Christadelphians, but the American Restoration Movement had been totally unknown to us. And that's why he wrote this booklet. There have always been Churches of Christ all through the years. It doesn't matter what century you look at. We heard yesterday in the last class of the day that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And that's absolutely true when we look at this. The farther back we go, the less evidence we have. But we do have little inklings, little traces through the years. And if you'd like to read this booklet, you can see some of those inklings and traces. I'll read you just a couple of examples of this type of thing. In the Furness district of Lancashire, England, there existed in 1669, during the reign of Charles II, a group of 8 Churches of Christ. Most of them are not now in existence. An old minute book has been found from 1669, and it shows that they called themselves by the name Church of Christ. They practiced baptism by immersion, kept the Lord's Supper each Lord's Day, and had elders and deacons. There was also a Church of Christ in Ireland in 1804, as well as in Arlington. In 1735, John Davis, a young preacher in the Fife district of Scotland, was preaching New Testament Christianity 25 years before Thomas Campbell was born. The Church of Christ traces its origin to the first century. The Restoration Movement owes much credit to the leadership of men like the Campbells, Barton Stone, etc., but the principle of New Testament Christianity finds its roots in the soil of apostolic authority. That's an important idea. I'll read you another vignette here. In the cemetery behind the Cane Ridge Church House, and I know some of you have been down to Cane Ridge just recently, others of you in times past have visited the Cane Ridge Meeting House down in Bourbon County, Kentucky, near Paris, Kentucky. In the cemetery, and I've seen this stone myself, in the cemetery behind the Cane Ridge Church House near Paris, Kentucky, is a stone which marks the grave of William Rogers. The marker reads, "Born in Campbell County, Virginia, July 7, 1784. Moved to Cane Ridge, Bourbon County, April 1798. United with the Church of Christ at Cane Ridge in 1807. Now, 1807 was 2 years before Alexander Campbell even came to America. So, you probably, all of you, if you've been out in the world and talked with people very much, you've been called a Campbellite. Anybody here ever been called a Campbellite? Sure you have. Lots of us have. We all have. You ever been called a Somerite? I have, lots of times. Been called a Ketchersideite? I have. Been called all these things, but those aren't what I really am. Even though I've been called those things, I'm going to suggest to you that there were people through the centuries who were sometimes called Lollards. They were sometimes called Albigensians. They were sometimes called Waldensians. They were sometimes called Anabaptists. I'm suggesting to you that the name that they often used for themselves individually was Christian, and the way that they would use for their congregations was Churches of Christ. But they weren't the ones who wrote the history. The winners, from an earthly point of view, were the ones who wrote the history. Their enemies called them these names. You know, this is what always happens. The Mormons use the name Mormon now, but they didn't originate that. It was a term of derision to begin with. They picked it up to take the sting away from it, and now they'll introduce themselves as Mormons. But it didn't start out that way. So these terms are used. I was down here in April doing some teaching over at Ozark, and happened to be over at Tom Allen's house one day, and he introduced me to this book called Traces of the Kingdom, which I think is a very well-researched piece of work. I'll put the man's name on the board. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Sisman or Seisman. Anyway, it's called Traces of the Kingdom. And the burden of the book, as he says on the front, is tracing the Churches of Christ in England who baptized believers for the remission of sins prior to the Reformation and up to the period of the Restoration movements in Great Britain and America in the 19th century. Using rare documents and books held in the British and Cambridge University Library, in light of modern research, evidence is for 1,000 years of the Churches of Christ in England. Now, that's what he's setting out to prove. Obviously, it's easier to prove the later 500 years of that than it is the earlier 500 years of it. One of the problems we have is when you talk about some individual in particular, it's difficult to know just exactly what they did believe at this late date. You'll find one source that says, here's what he believed, and some other source says, no, he believed this, and maybe that person never really wrote much, or if they did, it was lost. So we don't know. And of course, you and I don't need to know, because the Lord knoweth them that are his, and the Lord will make the exact right decision in every case. Somebody asked me after class yesterday, was Polycarp faithful, since he seems to have been the bishop of Smyrna at the time of his martyrdom? All I can say is we need to do the best we can, and God will make the decisions individually on all of us. I don't know. I have to sit on the love seat and let God sit on the judgment seat. We just want to stay as close to the Word as we can, understanding that when we depart from it, even incrementally, that can be the first step for somebody else to take a step further. We need to be aware of this concept constantly. But I did read this book, thank you, Tom Allen, and found it to be, well, I'll say the bad and the good about it. This might be partly flavored by the fact that I read a very well-written book right before I read this. I read a book that I've been waiting to be released for 10 years, and it's done by a very gifted author who works very hard. So that tainted everything I read afterward for a while. So I wish this was better written, and I wish it was better edited. It's very repetitive, and there's a lot that could have been done better. I mean, there's good material, but sometimes I don't think he knew quite what to do with it. But having said that, I'll say I think it's very well researched. He's done not only a great deal of research, but he's delved into things and gotten into areas that I didn't even know it was possible to go into. And I think if you're interested in this subject, as I know some of you are, it might be worth getting this. There's a website as well. I think it's tracesofthekingdom.org or com or something. I think you know how to find everything anymore. So you might enjoy this. Just don't expect it to be really well written. I mean, there are things that are just jarring in books sometimes when the author hasn't, in my opinion, given the time and attention that he might have to it. I'll give you one example of what I'm talking about so you won't be disappointed if you do read it. If I can find something here. This type of what I would say is a discrepancy. On page 370, Edward Whiteman died April 11, 1612. He was burned at Lichfield. He was the last to suffer in this way in England. Future heretics would be starved to death in prison, as were 9,000 under Charles II, who reigned from 1660 to 1685. But he said that Edward Whiteman, in 1612, was burned. He was the last to suffer in this way in England. Almost exactly 100 pages later, he says on page 471, the last member of the church to be burned alive in England was Elizabeth Gaunt on October the 23rd, 1685. So, I don't know what to do. There's just a contradiction there. There are several things like that in this book. And it's not unusual to find things like that in a book, but it just leaves me feeling incomplete, like something was unresolved. You'll find several things. Actually, what he does in this book, what he does best, he puts a whole bunch of dots out there, and he makes it possible for you to connect them if you want to. There's a lot of raw material here that's very good to have. And I can recommend the book with these little caveats that I'm giving you. It's a much more substantial work than this one by Hans Grimm that I've been recommending for a long time. And I think many of you would enjoy it. But one of the most interesting things about this book, since I know you have an interest in it, is he has some little maps in the middle of the book, beginning on page 226. No, beginning on page 224. He shows on page 224 where the Waldensians were in the late 1100s, and then where the Lollards were a couple of hundred years later, and it's the same place. He shows then on another map where the Anabaptists and the Lollards and the some of the other people were, and they're all in the same place. He shows them where the Anabaptists were. They're in the same basic place. And what he's saying is that these were the same basic people. Their names were changing as their enemies called them different things, but they were calling themselves Churches of Christ. And I have found that to be true. Generally speaking, we don't always know what people mean by Churches of Christ. I mean, even the Catholic Church calls itself the Church of Christ. So you don't always know what is meant by that. You have to be careful with that idea. But I think it's safe to say that numbers of people who were called Lollards or Waldensians or Albigensians or Anabaptists through the years most likely were our brothers and sisters in Christ and were often killed by the state churches, whether Catholic or Protestant. They were killed by the state churches for believing and practicing largely what you and I practice from the Bible today. And that's the burden of this book as well. So I think you would appreciate and enjoy that. Some of you would anyway. Richard?
What was the name of Anna Grimm's book?
Tradition and History.
I'll write it up here even though it's a little long.
Oh, that wasn't a religious book. I can tell you, but it's not germane to this class. Sorry.
Sometimes I leave the cap off things too long.
Tradition and History of Early Churches of Christ in Central Europe. And that is available online. They've left out a little bit of it online, I was told. But most of it's there. I don't know if it's still available in this form or not. And the well-written book was called The Passage of Power by Robert A. Caro. Just so I'm not being obnoxious and withholding information. It's about Lyndon Johnson. Best biography I've ever read, but that was the fourth volume of it. And he's still not done. But anyway, sometimes it does taint your palate a bit if you read something good and then some of these other things that we didn't work as hard in the writing of. Once the great apostasy got to a certain point of degeneration, there was no question but what it needed to be reformed, and you had more and more reformers stepping forward to the front. You've got John Wycliffe on your sheet here, being born in 1324. He tried his hand at translating the Bible. John Huss was another reformer. Finally, Martin Luther in 1483, being born. The important thing that happened before Martin Luther, or one of the important things, is the invention of the printing press. We have it here in 1456. Gutenberg's Bible being printed. It would be hard to overemphasize the coming of the printing press. Printing had been done by the block system in China earlier than that, but Gutenberg was using movable type, and the first book of any size to be printed with movable type was the Latin Vulgate of the Bible on vellum. He made 100 copies. There are only 3 perfect copies that remain, to my knowledge. One of those was purchased by the United States in 1930 for over $350,000 in 1930, purchased for the Library of Congress. So this is obviously regarded as a very valuable thing if you have a Gutenberg Bible. Well, once Gutenberg was doing this work, there were 1,000 other printers that immediately rose up. There were 30,000 books that hit the market almost all at the same time, and there was no going back. I mean, this was the computer of its era. The printed word. and paper began to be used extensively, and the world has never been the same since the invention of the printing press. In Wycliffe's day, they were having to make copies of the Bible by hand, the portions of it that they had translated into the vernacular tongues. But now we could print copies of the Bible just infinitely, and they would all be the same when we had a printing press. So the fact that Luther is born just shortly after this is serendipitous, if not providential, and we pass into the time where we become very familiar with this portion of history. There was a Dominican monk by the name of Tetzel who came into Luther's area of Germany, what we now call Germany. He came there selling indulgences. The Roman Church had gotten to the place where it was so calloused and hardened that it would sell indulgences, which were like a right to sin almost, and they were also to be purchased for your dead relatives. Tetzel, here's a good biography of Martin Luther, by the way, by Roland Baton. I'll put that name up there
so you won't have to ask.
Roland Baton wrote this biography of Martin Luther called Here I Stand, and it paints a picture of the times. He talks about Luther nailing his 95 Theses for debate to the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral in 1517. But the reason that he did that, and that's on your timeline, by the way, the reason he did this was because of what Tetzel was doing. Coming and fleecing these very, very poor people, that your dead mothers and fathers are in purgatory burning right now, and you have the power to release them. Now you can see how this would play on the hearts of simple people who believe everything the church is saying. And by the way, the church was the hierarchy. The church was not the common people. You had the clergy-laity split, where the real church is the hierarchy. The purpose of the people is just to basically to pay for the hierarchy. So he said to these people, you have the power to release. Can't you hear the voices of your dear dead relatives and friends saying, pity us, for we are tormented in this flame. You have the power to release them, for as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. You can get your relatives out of purgatory. All you got to do is pay them out. And the people would just give everything that they had to get their dead relatives out of this made-up place that the church had made up, purgatory, which the Bible never speaks about, and there's no hint in the Bible that there is such a place. Well, this was one thing that Martin Luther, as a sincere man, he was himself an Augustinian monk, he's a very strict Roman Catholic, and he loved his church. But he said, this is an abuse. If the Pope has the ability to get anybody out of purgatory, he's cruel if he doesn't let them all out right now. And that, of course, was true. So that's what prompted him to nail those theses for debate to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. And this is often looked at as the beginning of the Great Reformation of the 16th century. Now, you can take the position that John Wycliffe had started this back years before. He's known as the morning star of the Reformation, and some of these others that I mentioned, William Tyndale that I did not mention, may have been a member of the Church of Christ. He's talked about some in Sisman's book here. Another thing that complicates this is that people believe different things at different times in their lives. And so you can find one source that says this about a person, another source that says the opposite about a person, and they could both be true at different times in that person's life. I would like to believe that William Tyndale was in a safe condition, but of course we don't really know that about each other. Anyway, he translated the Bible, worked assiduously at this, and paid for it with his life. As he was being burnt at the stake, he said, Lord, open the King of England's eyes. It didn't seem to matter who was in charge. As long as they had power, they persecuted. You and I and our forebears are the people who never persecuted anybody. But it didn't matter whether it was a Catholic church or a Protestant church. If they had power to do it, they persecuted those who disagreed with them. The Lutherans put a lot of people to death. As long as you have a state church, you are in danger. There never will be a state church that is the same as the Lord's church. The state church operates on the basis that the world operates on. I started working in a donut shop when I was 16 years old. And I know if I took a little ball of yeast dough and a little ball of dough that was not full of yeast, if I put those together, I wound up with a bigger ball of yeast dough, because a little leaven leavens the whole lump. What was over here disappears and all becomes this thing that was over here. And that's what happens when the church unites with the world. This is what Constantine brought about when he did what he thought was going to be helpful by making Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire. Church and state cannot combine and be anything that's profitable to the Lord. They were intended to be different things. And they operate on completely different philosophies. The Church of the Lord operates on the basis of spirituality, that right makes might. Any human government operates on the principle that might makes right. It's just the opposite kind of an idea. You cannot mix them together. But that didn't keep us from trying for a long, long time. You had church and state combined. And the upshot of all of this was that it was just expected that in every country, or every American colony, for example, there would be an established church. In all of our 13 colonies, there was an established church at the beginning that was in bed with the government of that colony. And they decided if you had to go to church or not, and in most of them you had to go to church. You had to do this and that to assist the established church in that colony. This is what is meant in our founding documents when it talks about Congress shall establish no religion. It's talking about having an established church, that we should not do that anymore. After we finally had our Declaration of Independence and we're getting started as a country, the Pope of Rome wrote over to this new republic and asked the new government, what's our relationship going to be? And Benjamin Franklin wrote back and said, we have no position on that whatsoever. We're not going to have any relationship. We're not for you or against you. It's just not relevant to this thing that we're founding. You had finally, I believe, the devil being bound with the Word of God for a long time. The Bible uses the expression 1,000 years to refer for a long time. That he should deceive the nations no more, where church and state would be split apart from one another. John Adams with his voice and Thomas Jefferson with his pen had a great deal to say about this. These were not men who did not believe in God at all. But yet they did not want the government to be persecutorial when it came to religious issues. So it was freedom of religion, not freedom from religion, but freedom of religion, where your conscience would dictate to you what you should do. And as your conscience changed, you could change, because you were living in the land of the free. This was a wonderful new experiment that I believe the Lord predicted in the 20th chapter of the book of Revelation. Anyway, wherever you had this national church, there was grave danger. It would accumulate power and then it would persecute those whom it was suspicious of, because it felt like if we let these dissidents get started, they're not going to stop. They're going to keep going. They're going to keep preaching out of that Bible. And they would burn stacks of Bibles on the streets sometimes just to get rid of them, because they didn't want people going back to the Bible. King James, when he had the Bible translated, gave his translators, who, by the way, were wonderfully proficient linguistic men, they were better at Greek and Hebrew than you and I are at English. But he didn't just give them free rein to say, translate the Bible the best way you can. He gave them a list of 14 rules that they had to follow so it didn't get out of hand. Any government has the need to control. That's what it's there for. And he was a controller, just like most people in government. So he gave them rules that they had to follow. Don't translate it too well, in essence, was what he was saying. I want to be able to use this in the churches of England, because by then he was the head of the church. He broke away from the Pope because the Pope wouldn't let him divorce his wife and marry the other girl that he wanted to marry, Anne Boleyn. So he became the Church of England. But what's the difference between the Church of England and the Roman Catholic Church? It's just the difference is who the head is, and neither one of them has Christ for a head. If you're in the Lord's Church, your head is Christ and no man. This is just a difference of night and day. There's a great gulf fixed between the two ideas. As long as you have a national church, you're in danger. And they didn't get away from the idea of having a national church for a long time. They had a nationalism, growing nationalism after the Reformation. But one by one, these states that became independent from Roman Catholicism developed their own state church and were just as persecutorial as their predecessors had been. So we have a wonderful experiment in America going on here, and I hope that we don't just throw it away. I've had so many people ask about the restoration movement that I think I'm about ready to move over to that, unless there's something else that we should be talking about here. Anybody have any questions or comments on anything on this timeline or anything pertaining to the apostasy or the Reformation? Yes, Melissa? I'm sorry, Cheryl. Yeah.
People for centuries and centuries.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you said a while ago about man in the lust and God's in the judgment.
Right.
I feel that pertains to those
forms. Yes, and God will make exactly the right decision in every case. We have evidence, reason to believe, that when there is a sincere seeker after truth, the Lord will get the truth to them, and then they make a decision about the truth. We see this in numerous cases in the Bible, for example. You've got an Ethiopian eunuch going along, he's reading something he doesn't understand, but he happens to be a sincere seeker after truth. God knows where they all are, and they're rather rare, but he happens to be a sincere seeker of truth. So God got somebody to him to ask him the question, do you understand what you're reading? Well, how can I except somebody guide me? So he began at that same scripture and preached unto him Jesus. I can't prove it, but I believe that God providentially will get His Word to people through all kinds of agencies that God alone is able to weave together. The mind of God is sufficiently great, magnificent, and universal to be able to do that. In view of that question, let me read you a statement about what happened in John Wycliffe's time. Since he, as the morning star of the Reformation, translated the word into English or began that process and was instrumental in sparking a great revival of interest in the Bible, which eventually led to the changes that took place in the religious scene in the Reformation. The historian J.J. Blunt describes what transpires. An eager appetite for scriptural knowledge was excited among the people, which they would make any sacrifice and risk any danger to gratify. Entire copies of the Bible, when they could be only multiplied by means of copying, were too costly to be within the reach of very many readers. But those who could not procure the volume of the book would give a load of hay for a few favorite chapters, and many such scraps were consumed upon the persons of the martyrs at the stake. They would hide the forbidden treasure under the floors of their houses and put their lives in peril rather than forego the book they desired. They would sit up at night, sometimes all night long, their doors being shut for fear of surprise, reading or hearing others read the Word of God. They would bury themselves in the woods and would converse with it there in solitude. They would tend their herds in the fields and steal an hour for drinking in the tidings of great joy. What an attitude toward the truth of the Bible these people had, that they would pay so dearly when it came within their range of possibility. And it may well be that all through the years, even in the darkest of the dark ages, that when there was a sincere seeker after truth, that God would somehow providentially find a way to get the word to them. In most of those cases, we're not going to know anything about those people in this world, because it wasn't written down, or if it was, it has not survived. At least we haven't found it yet. Once in a while we do find something that we didn't know was there in a library, tucked in the corner somewhere. But for most of these people, we don't know. They were the unsung heroes of the faith and will be honored in heaven. But we just don't know. And it is good to know, as Cheryl is pointing out, that the judge of all the earth will do right, as it was said in Abraham's day. The judge of all the earth will do right in every case. And God has ways of getting information to people so that they can make a decision based on what they know. Good comment, good question. Thank you, Dwayne.
Yeah, is it reasonable to assume then that there were these copies, pirates, or whatever, however you call them, that were out there?
So. Yes. They had to always be out there. The main trouble was that they were locked up in a language that a lot of people could not read. Almost nobody could read it except the hierarchy of the church, the Latin language. And it became illegal to translate the Bible into the common languages that the people could speak and read. This was the illegality. This was how you took your life in your hands for translating the Bible, because the Church of Rome wanted control over that. And they didn't think you had the right to interpret the Bible. It was up to them to interpret the Bible and just we'll tell you everything you need to know. In essence, when the church speaks, the thinking has been done. It's just up to you to follow. That was the idea. Well, God gave you the Bible to understand through the mind that He gave you. But yes, all through the years, there were scraps of this in circulation. Yes, Jeannie. Yes. Right. And when you had to make a manuscript copy, a complete copy of the Bible in manuscript would be really thick.
We came across something very, very interesting when we were in Vienna. They had a Bible printing place there, and there was a young girl there from Romania when we were there that Sunday, and she said, "When are we going to get the next book of the Bible?"
In her language?
Yeah, in their language.
Mm-hmm.
They were just so outraged.
Right. Yes, that is a very touching thing to think of, and it's a great work to translate the Bible into a language where it's not been translated before. A great work. Yes, Dave. Yes.
And it was either a Kindle or a King James, but it had commentaries in it.
Right.
From the Restoration. I mean, from the Reformation, like Luther. And I've never seen one.
Yeah.
But that's my understanding. Is that correct?
Yes. And we have reason to believe that there were Christians. I'm talking about biblical Christians, believers baptized for the remission of their sins on the Mayflower when they came over. And they started the church in just a short time here in America, even at that time. And Sisman in this book addresses that issue in Traces of the Kingdom. And I think he's probably correct about that. So we have been in every country, or most every country, we've been around for 2,000 years. That was us. We were burnt at the stake. We need to identify with those people. That will help us if it happens again in our time, which it could. I mean, there's a lot of virulent antagonism around against us in our time, and I don't see that abating anytime soon. And if people get the power that some of them want against us, we may face persecution again. We ought not to be unduly traumatized by that. It's happened before. They've been burning us at the stake for years. They may do that again. It's a really interesting thing that God has built the human body so that it can only endure so much pain, and then you don't feel pain anymore. You either lapse into unconsciousness, or your nerve endings are just gone, so you're not feeling the pain anymore. We have records of people being burnt at the stake. These didn't used to be here. I have a hard time getting used to that. People being burnt at the stake, and after a certain point, the pain was excruciating at first, and then after a certain point, maybe their arms are burnt completely off,
But they're standing there conversing with people right beside the fire, experiencing apparently little or no pain at all because their nerve endings are gone. So God has equipped us so that we will not be tempted above that which we are able to bear. There is a limit to what they can do to us. You can either lapse into unconsciousness or just not feel the pain too much for some reason. That doesn't make it appealing in any way. But it will be short-lived. It will be limited if they do persecute you. Don't let them take your eternal salvation from you. Don't give that up. Go ahead and endure what you need to and let them give it their best shot. Fear not him that can destroy the body, but him that can destroy both body and soul in hell. It would be an easy task to fill a full hour with burnings and starvings and racks and torture. I don't know how beneficial it would be, but it would be easy to talk about our brethren, but we're not going to take the time for that, and Lord willing, we'll go on to the restoration movement tomorrow. Right now, you have 15 minutes.